So welcome everyone to this session. We have big shoes to fill if you guys know Ellen Schaefer. Just a correction though, that's okay. I'm actually the medical director for primary care for Planned Parenthood in Richmond, so
yeah,
more Southern Virginia.
Yeah,
but
not Northern Virginia. Yeah.
And I also just want to emphasize that our section, the medical care section, is very much supportive of Ellen's work. As you can see, the chair-elect and the chair-elect-elect are both pitching in for her. So that just gives more credence to this important task that she's undertaken. And of course, Ellen didn't have any disclosures. Jim doesn't either, and neither do I. So basically, access to safe, legal, affordable abortion care is an essential right, and we all are here probably for the reason that we all agree with that statement. And then going back to what Dr. Kimball was, that last discussion that was encompassing, not only does that involve sexual education, contraception, but also abortion. And it should be thought of as equally as comprehensive sexual reproductive health care. The place that the government has in this is they should create conditions that provide the right to choose whether women want to have children and at what age or at what station of their life they want to have children. And they should also provide the right to raise families in healthy communities free of violence. And that's just a general tenet. You all are familiar, you've all been looking at the news and probably involved in the fight that aggressive campaigns have been waging for years to reverse abortion access. Of course, this decrease as far as abortion being accessible by women when they need it, at the time that they need it, increases economic inequality and also increases health disparities. It violates the woman's right of, and also their family's rights to be powerful economically, both socially and also on a global scale. And also the restrictions constitute a threat to population health in general. And it does call for an engaged, concerted response, not only from the government or legislators or advocates, but also the public health community at large. Abortions are common, and you know, like I said, I work with Planned Parenthood, and we understand that abortions will never be zero. That, as the young lady mentioned out in the audience, that contraceptive devices fail; they're not 100%, and we are human, and we make mistakes. And why should we have to continue a pregnancy or have a child when we're not financially or have the ability to care for that child in an appropriate or desirable way. Just to give you some statistics, by the age of 45, about one-third of U.S. women will have an abortion. And actually, when you look at the risk of a childbirth compared to abortion, there's actually mortality is increased 14 times for a woman to have a natural birth. This is just a graph that is showing that deaths from abortion did decrease when we, first of all, had laws that were liberalized in at least 15 states, including New York, and more so when Roe v. Wade actually passed. The Hyde Amendment bans federal funding for abortions in the United States, and technically the law permits federal funding for certain exceptions, and in cases when the pregnancy is caused by rape or incest, or poses a threat to a woman's life. Now, this rule is not a permanent law, but it has been attached annually to congressional appropriation bills and has been approved each year by Congress since 1976. And Medicaid has been the primary target of the Hyde restrictions, as noted even in our own APH policy. It is jointly administered by, as you all remember, Medicaid is jointly administered by the state and federal governments, and states can actually determine many of the rules for eligibility, including the maximum income that is allowed to be considered. Only 17 states provide their own funds to cover abortions through Medicaid, and about one in four women who would have had Medicaid-funded abortions instead gave birth when the funding was not available. The ban on federal funding for abortions has been extended to cover even the federal employees' health benefit program, which insures 9 million federal employees and their dependents, more than 200,000 active duty women in the military, and 1.6 million female veterans, most of whom are still in reproductive age, and also 12,000 female inmates in the federal prisons, 5,000 women who are Peace Corps volunteers, and nearly 1 million American Indian and Alaska Native women who are recipients of the Indian Health Service health care. So as you see, that is very impactful to the society of women in large numbers. Now, HIDE also perpetuates stigma by lowering the standard of health care coverage based on gender or income, and again going through the exceptions only for rape and incest and threat to the life of the mother. Under those conditions, only 7 abortions were actually covered by Medicaid in 2010. It fractures the woman's experiences of access to abortion by her income, by race, level of education, and geographic location, and it's making us have a two-tiered system where some commercial insurances are covering this, but women who aren't able to afford commercial insurance coverage, unfortunately, are not having access to these services. And then you're looking at when ACA came about as far as public and private payment sort of coverage for these healthcare services. Now, as you see here, there's been a wave of restrictions, and mostly notable in 2011 from 2011 to 2013. And actually during that time period, 19 state governments enacted 135 regulations to limit access to basic reproductive health care. That is actually a record when you compare to the latest, the earlier figures we had in 2005, where only 34 regulations were enacted. The barriers that are apparent as far as what involves women, we talked about this earlier as far as having to make trips, not only long distances, but also some states requiring 3-4 trips to get an abortion. I know in the state of Virginia, we require almost 2. A woman is not able to get an abortion the same day that she has decided she has to have actually 24-hour waiting period. And then also there's limits on the provision of medication abortions. So, and again, I'm going anecdotally what my experience has been in Virginia. Even though I can write a prescription for mifepristone, some pharmacies don't carry it. So the woman has to actually come into the clinic and receive the medication more readily available. Even it's difficult for them to get the misoprostol. Decreasing the access. And then also the laws that some private insurance doesn't cover abortion, no matter how good the coverage is on other procedural, including doing gallbladder surgery, things like that, that are typically much more invasive. Women with those same policy plans aren't able to get their abortions done. And then also bans on absolutely not being able to provide abortions after 20 weeks. And I was even amazed by this last fact. 5 states that actually require physicians to tell women that breast cancer is linked to abortions. Just actual lies. I'm going to have to just say that. Just lies. And I would like to talk to those physicians. How can they provide medical care ethically and actually be able to tell a woman that? Now, most requirements apply to state standards for ambulatory surgical centers. That's the TRAP laws, and in Virginia, we are under the TRAP laws. We have a Democratic governor, Governor McAuliffe, who is actually having the TRAP laws reviewed and seeing if they can be just expunged. We have a public health group or commission that's looking over the laws and regulations and seeing what they can do politically that'll be expedient. So far, we are still waiting an actual final verdict. But a lot of our clinics in preparation, specifically Planned Parenthood, has been looking at contingency plans. And I know as a fact, Northern Virginia, our Falls Church Planned Parenthood, will not be able to meet TRAP regulations. We'll have to close. And a lot of the independent abortion providers will have the same problem. And these centers are being asked to meet surgical ambulatory care center standards, and we don't provide the intensive medical care that those surgical centers do or the sedation that's required for the procedures. They also require doctors and facilities to maintain relationships with the hospitals, even though they're not admitting physicians to those hospitals, and provisions that add nothing to existing patient protections. And it actually lets the hospitals determine if they will let doctors provide abortions in their community. They actually have veto power. And some of these regulations actually apply to physicians' offices where abortions are being performed, even if it's only a medication abortion. So we looked at the ACA, and a lot of us were excited because we had a big lobby. We had a lot of pro-reproductive health groups that were coming forward, and we thought that the ACA would give us carte blanche coverage as far as contraceptive, and as you all know, that didn't actually end up being the case, especially when we were looking at the coverage of pills and other IUDs, et cetera, et cetera. Now, going back to disparities, when we were mentioning before that having these restrictions is causing us to have health disparities, when you look at the definition, disparities include preventable differences in health status related to social categories and discrimination, and the social categories being under race, gender, income, and biological categories of age and genetics. This is a graph showing unintended pregnancy rates by income and race, ethnicity. And as you see, of course, women of color are affected mostly, and also women of color that have that are underserved and don't have the financial means to purchase these services. And this is another graph looking pretty much at the same thing, that unintended pregnancy is actually 5 times higher for low-income women. Another graph pretty much reiterating the same issue in a different form. And again, the take-home message is unintended pregnancies are actually going up for low-income women, but for higher-income women, since they are able to get access to abortion and other services, there we are actually seeing a decline. Again, this pretty much mirrors what we were seeing in unintended pregnancies as far as income and race ethnicity, that the a number of abortions that are being provided to these certain sects. Again, higher for women of lower means and also higher for women of color. Now, disparities are increasing, and the history shows that women will exert significant effort to overcome obstacles, including financial and regulatory, though often at significant cost to their health and economic security for themselves and their families. And the attacks around these obstacles are twofold. One is by removing funding, and another is by removing providers. And this represents a greater harm to women and their communities because it gives them less power and less resources, and it further a manifestation of the public health crisis. This is also seen because you have less access to actually comprehensive sexual reproductive health, and its outcome is more unintended pregnancies and birth. And as you see, the rates of abortion are declining more rapidly among white women than among black and Hispanic. And the thought behind that is, while they're somewhat related to preferences by race stemming from positive attitudes among women of color toward childbearing and from post-exploitation by healthcare providers, overall, desperate negative financial consequences of obstructing intention to obtain an abortion. Coercive obstruction of this intention is an abrogation of self-determination, and it constitutes a violation of social and political rights. Now, here there was an actual study called the Turnaway Study, and it compared women who presented for abortions were denied for various reasons with women who succeeded in obtaining them. The Turnaways had more significant negative outcomes in their physical health and economic stability. The women in the Turnaway group suffered more ill effects, including higher levels of hypertension and chronic pelvic pain. Economically, the results are even more striking. Adjusting for any previous differences between the groups, women denied abortion were 3 times as likely to end up below the federal poverty line 2 years later. Of course, most of you know in the audience, having a child is expensive, and many mothers have trouble holding down a job while they're also caring for an infant. And of course, you know, we all understand the connection between poverty and shorter lifespan. That 55-year-old woman at the bottom of the income distribution can expect to live a decade less, 80 years versus 90, than a woman of the same age at the top of the income distribution. I'm just speeding through. I had a little warning. Women under 250% of the poverty actually had increased 22% as far as the number of women, again, that are being disaffected by this system. And the total population of that same age group only increased by 12%. And, of course, we already talked, what Dr. Kimball was talking about, anti-abortion states have worse population health outcomes. Now, how did we get here? Well, of course, we go back to 2008 where we had a very historic financial crash. And then what happened is people still of low income and also people of color have yet been able to recover from that crash. What usually we're seeing is that the rise as far as income levels is mostly going to the top 2% versus the people in the middle or lower class. Now, we did have during the Obama administration that they did cut middle class taxes and also passed health insurance reform, but we already know the drawbacks there. And this is actual Ellen's way, the impersonal.
Voice of Ellen.
Yeah, talking about the Koch brothers and how, again, we're seeing this change or shift even to more right-wing beliefs and regulations being put forward. They're mostly, their sort of wedge issue is, again, talking about control of women's bodies and what they can do with their reproductive health. And it pretty much is a discrimination against women, and it also is a call to us to come up with a strategy. How can we reverse this march down the wrong path? Again, talking about stigma, and Ellen did mention in here that there is a reverse campaign proposed by the University of California, San Francisco, talking about conscientious provision of abortions. Again, being more proactive and claiming back the language. Conscientiously committed practitioners often need courage to act against prevailing legal, religious, and even medical orthodoxy, following the honorable medical ethic of placing patients' interests above their own. And the course at the University of California is, if any of you are able to access this online, it's a free course. Unfortunately, it's midway, so a lot of you guys will have to do some catching up. But it's actually talking about getting rid of the stigma around abortion. And then also Planned Parenthood has been having webinars, same for their staff. So I think this is a push, again, to reclaim the language. Again, we talk about, as far as religiosity, most doctors in Catholic-affiliated hospitals opposing restrictions on tubal ligation following C-section. And most employees at religious schools actually support reproductive health care that's comprehensive and includes all choices. And so do members of Congress and the Supreme Court, even though they don't want to admit it. Now, where do we stand as public health community? We know that through our previous policies as far as APHA is concerned, we as organizations support abortion rights. And the public health community, we need to identify and overcome the impact of stigma on suppressing public discussion, debate, and action on abortion. We need to recognize the disproportionate impact of abortion and stigma on relatively less powerful people and on population health. And we need to engage our peers, community, and policymakers to support universal access to safe, legal, and affordable sexual and reproductive health services, including abortion care. And Ellen actually coined this phrase. She's calling for an emergency public health response to protect and advance population health by embracing abortion under the auspices as comprehensive reproductive health care. And we need to recognize and take action on public health's unique capacity and obligation to confront and overcome this stigma and assert access to abortion care in all aspects of sexual reproductive health as a fundamental requirement to achieve health in all policies. Thank you. We do have a sign-up sheet that Ellen is wanting to get a movement going through APHA that if you agree with these policies, you're not necessarily signing up right now for action, but we would like to kind of keep the dialogue going. There's a policy that's being prepared, so we definitely want input from a larger group. So please sign up, and we will keep in touch with you and give you updates on our progress. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Renee.